Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zier.
And I'm Daisy Alioto.
And Daisy, who are we speaking with today?
Today, we're talking to Dani Loftus. She's a founder, writer, and investor focused on the digital evolution of culture, specifically fashion. And she also edits DIRT's Instagram native magazine for creative complaining, aka Ick. And
can we get
are definitely going to talk about Ick
chat
today. Yeah, I get some you. I'm really excited to talk with her. She's a fascinating person. She also just moved to New York from London. And before that was in Mexico City for a long time. So she might have some interesting anecdotes about moving continents in the year 2025.
Yeah. A complicated thing. I feel like I haven't talked to you in like a month. It's been a busy week. I was in New Orleans for ONA, Online News Association conference. Spoke in a panel there, but what sticks most in my memory, of course,
Had your birthday while you were down there.
And had my birthday.
And what did you eat to celebrate your birthday?
Well, I went with my friend, one of my couple of good friends who still lives down there, to Eviva. E-V-V-I-V-A. I would highly recommend to anyone visiting New Orleans. I'd wanted to go because my favorite restaurant when I lived there was Margie's Grill, which is their whole thing was like Southeast Asian meets Southern, the barbecue of both, like, you know, grilled pork shoulders with like Thai dipping sauce and herb wraps, etc. But this place, that place closed down, but the chef owner is now a chef at this place, Eviva. So we had like all sorts of seafood, you know, grilled and draped in herbs and lemon. Maybe the best bite there was some frog legs, which...
Wow.
Have you ever had frog legs, Daisy?
I actually haven't, but not from...
Disgust.
Yeah, like nobody's ever offered one to me. I would eat one.
Well,
I would eat
them.
Like anything. I'm not picky at all.
Yeah, you never really see them. I mean, you see them a lot in New Orleans. I feel like outside of New Orleans, you don't see them that much. It's one of those things that's like, yeah, it tastes like chicken, whatever. It was so insane that they were like so impossibly... tender, like silky strands of white meat, again in herbs, drip some lemon on there. I also had a delicious
all the preparation.
Also had a delicious pickled watermelon rind martini, which I've had plenty
really
gimmicky martinis. There's an epidemic of gimmicky martinis, but this one was exceptional.
That sounds really delicious. Again, regretting podcasting through my lunch hour, but
I'm so sorry.
I saw in the notes you highlighted one of my tweets. So you want me to defend this, or
no? I don't want you to defend it. I think it's a good tweet. I thought I saw this graph, and it's absolutely shocking. I don't know. Maybe Tom will make a clip out of this. We'll see. But basically, the gist of this is that high income Americans, which I believe means people making over $200,000 a year, high-income Americans are behind roughly half of all U.S. consumer spending, up from about a third in the early 1990s. So that's the tweet you're quote tweeting. Which is insane. Like, that is such an insane statistic. But makes sense, I guess. You know, those with more money will spend more money on consumption. But what is your take on this tweet?
Well, I had already seen that stat floating around, and I did literally sent like a 10-minute voice memo about it to Natasha and Dina, which got like the beginning of it got screenshotted and put on Twitter. But like, I started thinking about this around like the cost of the U.S. Open tickets, because I was like, who is buying these?
It was like $3,000 for the cheapest ticket to the final or something.
Right. Because you hear like the majority of Americans are, you know, one medical bill away from being broke, but then you're also like supposed to believe that a significant portion of the population could afford like thousands of dollars of US Open tickets.
Well, not a significant portion though, right?
Well, a meaningful portion though, right? I think gerrymandering is a good word for this, because like if your vote gets gerrymandered, you basically end up in a situation where like, yes, you still have one vote, but your vote does not matter. And the economy has historically responded to people voting with their dollar. But if all the spending has been gerrymandered up into a smaller portion of the population, then like people can't vote with their dollar anymore, which has actually been a really big source of change in America in the past. And I think that's like, it's almost equally as dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. Because if
So the tweet you wrote here was that American consumption is being gerrymandered by people with the worst taste imaginable. We have to rebuild the media infrastructure that keeps their crassness in check. But I think to put it in terms, to make sure I'm understanding this right, like basically my, you know, joke about an epidemic of gimmick martinis earlier, it's like there's an epidemic of gimmick martinis and all these food publications writing about them because there are people in large cities spending a lot of money at expensive restaurants on gimmicky martinis, which then makes people write about gimmicky martinis, which then makes everybody think they have to be drinking gimmicky martinis, something like that.
Right. And also like advertisers are only interested in magazines that talk to these high spenders. Mm-hmm. And so the magazines and newsletters are incentivized to speak to their taste. But having finally finished Empire of the Elite, that's really not the way that it used to work at all. Hmm. Like, I think everything is cyclical, right? But like part of the reason Graydon Carter was hired to be the editor of Vanity Fair was because he had Spy, which made fun of these people. Hmm. And it was influential because it made fun of them. And then, of course, he started at Vanity Fair. And part of what happens when you have to like cover the elite from more of the inside is you start to get worn down and you're like less hard on them. Mm-hmm. So then what's supposed to happen is somebody else is supposed to come up and make fun of you and make fun of the establishment and swing the pendulum back. But if the power of American spending gets so entrenched with the top 10%, not all of them are tasteless. A lot of them are. Then you sort of lose that like fourth estate of culture, because it's like, who's going to fund the people making fun of rich people and kind of like keeping mm-hmm. them honest, in check, and like, frankly, insecure about whether they're surrounding themselves with enough people who are actually genuinely creating new stuff, edgy stuff. And that has historically been the role of the media. And you can see that cycle in Condé Nast, like they were too late in adapting to consumer, like the reason Tina Brown came in and was able to unseat the person who's running Vanity Fair mm-hmm. before is like they were too late to the new consumer taste of the 80s, which was really crass compared to the previous era. So they came in and catered to it, but they were to a certain extent also to keeping it in check. And now it's like, it's really run amok. And if the pendulum can swing back, it's going to swing back really, really, really hard to hipsterdom because of that.
But I bet Danny has some thoughts on that.
Oh, yeah. Let her in.
Let her in. When Danny came in, Daisy, you were saying that this is going to create a return to hipsterdom. What do you mm-hmm. mean when you say hipsterdom in this context? You mean like people choosing alternative culture that doesn't require as much spending?
It's kind of like the W. David Marks thing of like, people start making really weird stuff and it eventually gets integrated into the mainstream. Like the pendulum will swing back to like the people making weird, illegible stuff. Cause my theory, and I don't know how you would like put this in economic terms, is like rich people eventually get sick of their own bullshit and they always have this insecurity of like, everyone's having fun without me. Mm-hmm. Like it literally doesn't matter if you're Elon Musk and you own Twitter. Like, there is this like really guiding like emotional force in him that's like, everyone's having fun without me. And so like when rich people get sick of their own bullshit and like each other and like Surf Lodge and whatever, they're always like, okay, what are the poors up to? Mm-hmm. Right? Because like nothing is more validating than to be able to go back down and LARP with artists who are genuinely like working class, struggling, creating weird stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the classic cycle of like a nightclub, right? Where like at first it's people who are in a scene who come mm-hmm. and spend their money, and then like 10 years later, they're barely there anymore and it's all bridge and tunnel.
Or like artist gentrification. I mean, Danny, like I'm sure you have an interesting perspective on like how this went down in like Mexico City, but like Williamsburg now has a Chanel and mm-hmm. it was already on its second or third wave of gentrification by the time I moved to New York. But like if you look at it in like a city, as like a microcosm of the economy, like artists go where they can afford and then they make it cool and rich people follow. Mm-hmm. Like that cycle happens you know, with everything. But the problem is, like, in media or in a city, if nothing is inexpensive anymore, like, where do those people go to even, like, create the stuff that's going to get rich people looking around and saying, wait, something fun is going on over here. I need to, like, be involved.
I think the thing that's very interesting about what you say is I'm wondering if the framing applies only to people who are rich, who have, let's say, a degree or a touch of liberal values. Mm-hmm. So, like, let's say you frame it in WASPs. Mm-hmm. WASPs, no matter what, are not going to be like, you know what I'd love to do? Sit in a dive bar in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Similar way, like, aristocrats, another example. Or, like, the first thing that came into my head was when I went to Korea. And I thought, because I think what I see as somebody who indexes for, like, cool mm-hmm. over consumer spend, I was like, Korea is going to be sick. I've seen all of this edgy stuff. It's going to be sick. It actually is the place with the highest concentration of luxury stores. Mm. And we see K-pop, we see a degree of, like, oh, cool, hot cultural edge. But actually, in reality, the style is incredibly preppy. And I watched an entire Korean reality, not reality TV show, but, like, Gossip Girl-esque TV show before going. And actually, it's incredibly regimented. It's very preppy. It's very flaunting of wealth. So I don't, and, like, you know, when I think, I grew up in London. So yes, of course, there are a degree of what we like to call them in London, which is trustafarians. So people whose family have insane amounts of money, but they like to go to Notting Hill. And I think also the difference between England and America is we have something called the poorer you look, the richer you are. If you come from an incredibly wealthy family, in general, it's very cool to talk about how you can't afford anything and, like, be a bit grubby. But then, you know, you fly off on the weekend to your parents' island in Mystique. Whereas in the US, we don't quite do that yet. And I wonder if it's also something cultural where people who are ultra conservative or exist in countries which have maybe newer money or conservative value systems will never tend towards hipsterdom because that simply isn't even seen as cool, interesting. And it's actually ostentatious flaunting of wealth after flaunting of wealth.
I would push back on that. At least, you know, I went to a small liberal arts college in Portland, Oregon. And, you know, there's these kids who dress like shit and would skateboard barefoot, longboard barefoot around on campus. And then those are the kids who, you know, whose parents were paying the full price of admission and yet they were leaving with no student debt, right? And I don't know, maybe there's differences here on the East Coast, but, like, there for sure is, like, oh, the grimiest kid who is, like, again, skateboarding barefoot for no reason, like, they perhaps have the most money.
Well, I think that, but I think you're agreeing though on the sort of, like, grubbiness as a signal.
Yeah.
I would say with the WASP thing, at least in the United States, WASPs historically would mingle with poor creative types in the educational environment. So like they would go to the Ivy League schools and the little Ivy League schools, and then they would fall in with the Bohemians who were the scholarship students, and they would stay together kind of socially throughout their lives with some sort of benefactor relationship. So
some patronage.
Yeah. Like what really brought this to mind for me was like this Wall Street Journal article about people sitting in the Hamptons panicking about Zohran Mamdani becoming mayor of New York because he's a socialist. And historically, like Champagne socialists and WASPs were like partying together. They were all friends because they would have met at like Harvard or Princeton. And you, if you were the Champagne socialist, you were the poor friend, but you were also like the entertainment because you were like writing novels or whatever for your rich friends to read, participate in.
I feel like the, sorry, down for a second. I feel like the barefoot skateboarder, that's what I was looking for. The barefoot skateboarder, like they're the type too, who's going to make you Venmo for the happy hour beer, right? Like there's the separation of the patronage.
Totally. But like I went to college with Zohran in one of those environments that has historically mixed poor and richer people who will sort of like kind of stay in touch as time goes on. And because of that, like WASP value of being on the museum board or being a patronage of the arts or really valuing education, it kind of gives this illusion of like upward mobility, but it's kind of like that every wealthy social circle has these like bohemian ride-alongs. And so like for these people in the Hamptons to be panicking about Zoran, it's like, I know those people like aren't old money, because nobody who's old money would be genuinely threatened by somebody who's basically a champagne socialist who went to college with Kennedy's, like, which we did. So it's this weird, like, it's new money, new values, and new spending habits. And I don't know, you're right. Like, do people with conservative values just tune it out? And if that's the case, though, why are they so like up in arms about Cracker Barrel or like Super Bowl commercials that like don't reflect what they want the world to look like? Like, if you're a mega church pastor living in middle America and you have millions of dollars, like, who cares? I think, though, there's always this desire for the approval of the artistic class, whether they'll admit it or not.
You mean, what do you mean? So when you say about like the Cracker Barrel or something, who cares? You're saying like, why does the person who has the wealth and power care about this thing?
I'm saying like, even if they have conservative values, there's some part of them that like wants to be able to buy a Rothko. You know, like right now, for so long, like in the US, it was that Republicans have political power, but leftists had cultural power. Now they're using the power of the state to try to make sure they have cultural power too, by capturing like media and podcasts and brands and stuff that has historically been like really liberal. But like, there's only so much you can do, right? You can't stop somebody from going up on the stage at the Emmys and saying, fuck ICE. And the richer they get, I think the angrier they get that they even have to see that.
Because money should be able to buy everything.
Right. Money should be able to buy everything, but money can't buy other people thinking that you're cool. And that's why, no matter how Danny disagrees.
to a degree. I mean, there are definitely people who have bought their way into being cool, but I understand what you what
this
you,
is actually a great seg away so from my Daisy rant to something that I wanted to talk to you about with you, Danny. You told me about this book that I had actually never heard of that's being reissued with Apartmento, which I think is an incredible magazine and brand, and it's called Fashion Victim.
Happy Victims.
Oh, Happy Victims. Okay.
It's next to me.
Tell us about this book, because I actually think there's an interesting consumer story here.
So, I mean, first of all, I think the thing that's very important is that I have like a problem where I have to buy clothes all the time. And I have been in like an extreme shame cycle because I'm living with my partner for the first time and he's witnessed the problem. And like, I feel very judged for it. And I think also to clarify, I'm not always buying clothes, but there's something that I feel incredibly cathartic and stimulating at the same time about understanding where everything I want is and bidding on it and seeing how cheaply I can get it. And like, it's what I do when I need to switch my brain off. Like, when I'm doing the other things that I enjoy, like reading, watching films, consuming culture, I feel like I need to be taking stuff away 24/7. I'm like, I have situations multiple times where I'm like, oh, I'm reading this, but my brain can't adequately process it. How am I going to remember the information? I need to skip onto something else. My brain is fried. Like, that happens to me a lot. The process of looking at clothes and then finding them very cheaply, there is no mental energy exerted there. It's a little bit like going on Tumblr in a way that's active with like some type of financial component. I also like think clothes are an art form. So the reason that this book, this kind of brings it onto why this book is very appealing to me. So basically it's called Happy Victims. And it is by a photographer whose name I am now about to like grossly mispronounce, but his name is Kyochiki Suzuki. And it starts with a beautiful quote that I'm about to find, which is, there is a kind of accepted hierarchy of collecting in society. At the top are books and fine art, then music, cars, and so on. Clothes and shoes come at the bottom. Collectors of clothes don't command much respect, but I have great admiration for these people. That's why I call them happy victims. Many are shy young kids, and this is like a salvation for them. And I'm like, wow, I've never felt more seen. So essentially, he went around Japan photographing people who live in these tiny apartments who are dedicated to the collection of clothes, often just by a single designer. So it's images of these tiny apartments, and then the person will have a collection of Alexander McQueen, like strewn all over the floor, that is probably worth 3 years of their rent. And they are really ascribing to the cult of the designer. And it's also resonant for me because I think because of the pure nature of fashion, because we have, you know, at the one end, we have Chain, at the other hand, we have Alexander McQueen, you know, Jean-Paul Gaultier, et cetera, et cetera. And because fashion is or has been inherently tied to the body or physical form, it's seen as inherently superficial in a way that fine art collection is not. And I personally disagree with that. I think there is insane quantities of craft in fashion at the top end. I think just because buying fashion at the bottom end is common because there is a degree of physiological necessity to wearing clothes that there isn't with art, it doesn't negate the fact that you could go to Times Square and pick up a $15 painting or grab something in Soho for $15. And that is still art. But because fine art collection is so much more common, and also fine art collectors have developed so much more of a narrative, not to mention the fact that historically fashion collection and consumption has been seen as a traditionally female collector form and thus has been further denigrated, that it's not still actually a form of collection that should be respected.
Well, it's almost like if you're comparing it to fine art, it's like fashion collection is like photography collection, in that there's usually multiples in fashion, usually many more multiples than in photography. In fine art photography, usually it's quite a limited print run, right? Whereas with a painting, there's only one of each painting. I mean, I think that's part of it too, right?
I think it is, but then, you know, saying that, I have like a couple of, first of all, I have a couple of pieces that like there are three of them.
Yeah.
And I also think, for me, like the kick with anything is like, I like to find stuff that I know is worth a bunch of money that nobody else knows about. The Real Real absolutely crushes for that. Like, first of all, I will not buy a mainstream luxury brand ever from at full price. I think it is absolutely nuts that anyone does that anymore when you have The Real Real, you have Vestiaire Collective, you have eBay, like, come on. Then it's also about finding archive pieces. Like I have like quite a lot of stuff that I bought for like $200 that I see is being sold for $3,000. Mm-hmm. And as my mom always said, I would be a great vintage dealer if I wasn't obsessed with keeping everything. And you know, with those pieces, it will be like, you know, I have stuff from like early John Galliano when he was at Dior. Mm-hmm. And obviously whoever was selling it didn't know how much it was worth, but in the same way as when you're collecting a fine art piece, it's imbued with the history of the piece and then the trajectory of the artist or creative who made it. There's also obviously a thing where, because in general, the way that you display fine art is static. If I have an art piece, or like I have an art piece over here on my wall, it being on my wall probably does not mean that it's going to get broken or it's going to atrophy over time. Whereas every single time I wear a piece of clothing, it is being ruined. Mm-hmm. But I still like, I don't know. Look.
It's so cool. But so Danny, good. With you said The Real Real Vestiaire Collective, like, are you still relying on the arbitrage play of the person not knowing what they're selling? And like, has the internet made it harder? Because now like people can use AI or ChatGPT to identify stuff. Like, is it harder to find things that aren't underpriced?
No, it's all about understanding the consumer base and knowing where to look. Mm-hmm. So great example is The Real Real. Obviously, The Real Real is the American market, but when I think of a Real Real consumer, I think of like Hampton's mum. So if you are looking for stuff like Ralph Lauren or Kite or Tory Burch or Chanel, that stuff is high priced. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for avant-garde fashion, way, way underpriced, like Comme des Garçons, Andre Mulamista, Rick Owens. People in the US who shop on The Real Real clearly do not know how much that is worth. So that's being undersold. If you go on Grailed, that's being oversold. And then it's like other stuff, like Depop is very, very much Gen Z trend focused. So everything Y2K there is now massively overpriced. Vivienne Westwood corsets, no way. And then you also have interesting stuff like, I think, could be wrong on this, but I think eBay is much bigger in the UK than it is in the US. You can get crazy. Like, this is a Vivienne Westwood t-shirt that I got from eBay for probably £80. I just saw it sold, it's selling on US eBay for $500.
Wow.
So it's like, it's understanding where people are going for stuff. If I wanted to be, and Vestiaire Collective is very good for European brands. Mm. And I also think it's platform dynamics. So like the real like screws sellers over like mad. Like it's actually nuts. Like I've never sold anything there, but I know from the price I'm buying stuff, like how much you're giving these people, like 50p from like the stuff they're selling. Like I got a pair of Elder Statesman tracksuit bottoms the other day, which are full cashmere, retail price $2,000 for $200. Like, what? And they were in pristine condition. So it's like, it's wild. Mm-hmm. It speaks also to the oversupply of fashion. And then the other thing that you have to understand to kind of hack the system is which platforms accept binding offers and which don't. Mm. So Vestiaire Collective, for example, you can bid. And if people accept your bid, you don't have to buy it. So like, that's also what I do. I'm like, okay, I could, how much could I get this for? And then I don't go through with the transaction. Yeah. eBay does not do that. So I did once make a mistake where I bid, like I lowball bid something just to see. And then it was like, this much money has been taken out your account. And I was like,
One thing with the Real, as I understand it, I've never sold on the Real, but like you just mail them the stuff and then they photograph it and sell it for you, right? Whereas Grailed, which I've sold on Grailed, like you have to do all that. That's all on your end. So like, of course, you are also going to then put it at a higher price because like you feel like you're selling it more directly, a little less mediated, whereas the Real is so mediated. And so also the people who are selling there probably don't really care so much about getting a buck back for it. They just want to get rid of it and like get a little bit for it back without like.
That's why the really Real is money. A bad business though. They've taken on all the costs of custodying everything. It's actually better to do the decentralized consumer tools for selling it yourself, in my opinion, and then be the platform discovery.
But the Real also set the price for you. Mm-hmm. So like Grailed or Vestiaire or eBay, you set the price. Mm-hmm. The Real set the price. And then as I know, as a consumer, they drop the prices. So like what I'll do is I'll set an alert for something knowing that they are going to drop the price by $50 like every week.
Yeah.
Did the Real IPO? I remember that was like a big conversation.
They did.
I think so.
They IPO'd and then they...
Give us the numbers.
It's okay. So basically the stock has diminished like 65% since they IPO'd. Well, I also think some of this is like dynamics around people were shopping a lot during COVID.
Is that when the Real went public?
No, they IPO'd in 2019. So I guess like right before.
Were people shopping a lot during COVID?
Well, they were buying certain types of things, right? Like we had Andy Hunter on our last episode who runs bookshop.org, which is it aggregates stock from indie booksellers to compete with Amazon. And COVID was great for them. I also like, you have to remember there was that bump of crypto wealth during that period. True. This was like Clubhouse era and people getting like their stimulus checks and their Bored Ape Yacht Club checks. So I do think people were buying stuff. Yeah.
But you think they were, because from my understanding, they were buying loungewear and then they were, I mean, this is why we had a whole digital asset boom, because people were buying things that they could use to get the same kind of validation that they get wearing a new physical outfit out. Mm-hmm. So they were buying things that gave them acceleration in digital worlds or accelerated their status. And then I feel like they were really treating themselves at home with like, beauty and loungewear,
yeah,
and candles. I mean, with the exception of me, who bought a massively underpriced Christian Kane like gown, which also, by the way, is completely useless because it's white and it looks like a wedding dress, so I can't even wear it to weddings. But I had it on a mannequin behind me, and I would look at it every day when I was locked in my house, and I'd be like, oh, one day.
Well, Tom Bettridge, in his newsletter content today, who he was the VP of creative and content at Essence up until a year ago, I believe, right? He published this newsletter today, What Really Happened at Essence. I'm not behind the paywall, so I can't read the whole thing. Ooh. But this was on my mind today where he was saying, what was it? I mean, fashion e-com in general has cooled after being red hot during the pandemic, which, again, I'm not behind the paywall, so I didn't read it all. But I immediately thought of that when he said something about, like, were people really buying during the pandemic? I would trust him to have known that, having been at Essence, right?
Oh, please send this to me, because I, first of all, I am like, I love Essence, obviously. I also read something before they were going bankrupt, which was to do with the fact that they massively disenfranchised emerging designers, because the whole way they even make money is through the consistent
That discount. Blackbird spy plane piece, that was so good. Blackbird spy plane's like best thing they've ever written.
Exactly. And I mean, it's hard because Essence obviously needs to make money. The reason I like Essence is because they pioneer emerging designers who, you know, probably very hard for them to get visibility in other places. It's also a very different consumer base than like a Bergdorf or a Saks Fifth Avenue or a Net-a-Porter or a Moda Operandi. But nonetheless, it's shitty. Like, starting a fashion brand is incredibly hard. It's incredibly resource intensive. And it's very hard to make the numbers add up regardless.
Okay, well, okay. So to get back into it, I did want to talk. Is it Doji? Doji?
Doji. That was going to be my transition as well. Like, Danny, you wrote about Doji before the Essence bankruptcy was announced. Like, what role do platforms like Doji play in what the space that Essence used to occupy?
Well, what is Doji too, for any listeners who aren't aware? For me too, I've never used it. So to me, it's like, oh, this is a place where it's like this kind of AI-enabled thing where you can pick a piece of clothing. Let's say you're on Essence shopping and you can say, oh, well, what would that look like on me? And then you can, like, it'll apply it to your avatar. This is my understanding of Doji.
Yeah. I think, first of all, what I'll say as a caveat is Doji and all of these companies in the AI try-on space are very early. So I think part of the bets around the way that they are raising, like Doji, for example, $14 million, it's not based on what they are today, but also based in the way that they can pivot and what they can become. So that's like my disclaimer for anyone who listens to this in the next 6 months, where it may have completely changed. But what it started off as was a app that allowed brands to increase conversion rate via virtual try-on. So what it does is you take 12 images of yourself. It makes a virtual avatar of you. You can try on any piece from any clothing brand, and then there's a click through to that clothing brand, that shop. And it's interesting because I think I've been in the fashion tech space for like 5 years now, so quite a long time. And when I first started, this was all being done with augmented reality. And during the pandemic, the amount that there was like waxing lyrical about like how people being able to see an augmented reality fashion piece on themselves was completely changing the game for returns and conversion. Like, Shopify posted these like insane statistics. I don't know where they got them from, around like how many people converted after seeing themselves in AR. And even like me, who like started off as doing like a lot of, you know, digital fashion work. You know, I have an Instagram called This Outfit Does Not Exist, where I wear virtual clothes, all of that. I was kind of like, I personally have never been sold seeing something in AR on myself. This is nuts. And I think the other thing that's important to note is returns are a multi-billion dollar problem for fashion retailers. If you can crack that, you're crushing it. People have been trying to crack that for 15 years. And one of the biggest problems is size and fit. So it doesn't actually matter if, let's say, Daisy could see that that fuchsia blazer is going to look fantastic with her skin tone if it arrives to her house and it doesn't fit her. And no company, including Doji, is actually solving that problem.
I agree. Yeah.
So it's a very interesting space. And the thing that I'm interested to see is, like, you know, one of the things I said candidly to Dorian was, I was like, it's obviously sick that I can try on anything.
Is Dorian the founder of Doji?
Yeah. So sick that I can try anything on, but quite frankly, when I first got Doji like 6 months ago, I used it. I was obsessed with it. I used it every day. Like, my ego, my vanity kicked in. I was like, look, it's me, but I'm hotter and thinner and taller. And I'm wearing like so much Rick Owens. I'm the best. And then You know, now am I using it when I shop? Not really. And I think there needs to be some additional incentive. Like, if I knew that if I bought something through Doji, I would get 5% off, or if I shared an image of myself wearing it, I got a discount. I think that kind of push is needed for consumer behavior, unless they pivot it into like something like the company Jenny Wang founded, who I also know, I think it's Alta, is doing, which I think their thing is building a clueless closet, which I think potentially has more of a business case, because the thing that is obviously incredibly long to do is go into your closet, photograph everything, and have a virtual stylist who takes your clothes and then helps you to style things. I think that's like a very arduous task to begin with. But you could then quite easily plug into sites like Essence, Net-a-Porter, Moda Operandi, where every single time something got bought, it could go into your closet. And then hypothetically, number one, it could help you with styling, but then I could go into one of your closets and maybe make bids on your clothes. So for me, there's more of a business case for something like that at this point than just virtual try-on or virtual styling.
Yeah, I mean, for me too, like, I own three shirts from this one brand that are all the same model of shirt, but from different years and in different fabrics, and they all fit me slightly differently. And like the shoulder seam is a little more dropped on this one, a little higher on this one, right? And so having wasted so much money over the past decade plus buying clothes online and returning them or selling them on Grailed for a loss or whatever, thinking that they would fit or that they would look good on me, and like learning that lesson over and over, it's like there's zero reason for me to trust the try on thing. Like, to me, it's a little different from like when I was a teenager playing World of Warcraft and like wanting the specific set of armor for my character because I thought it would look cool, right? Like that, the Doji to me is more similar to that than it is like a practical tool for my shopping. Like now I'm much more like interested in going to the physical store and trying stuff on and only spending the money if I've tried the thing on in person and seen that it would fit, because I just can't bear to like lose another $100 having to resell something I bought and then immediately resell it, right? But yeah, to me, it's much more like Doji is much more akin to a video game experience than any practical shopping experience.
I mean, the thing that I'll say, which obviously I caveated at the beginning, is Dorian and his co-founder, I really think are incredible founders. I think that they are in the very, very, very tiny slither of people who hit the sweet spot between technical expertise and actually having taste. And the fact that they have $14 million means that they can pivot this. They can try to, you know, they could literally directly compete with something like Alta. They could work on fit tech. I think the $14 million investment was very much a potential bet. And given what they built with $1.5 million or $2 million that they raised initially, I do think the things that we're just discussing are very much directions in which they could go.
Yeah. Well, so like ways they could go that I see to that would make it more practical to me is like, one, maybe every month or quarter or whatever, you're prompted to do like some full body scan that you can do with your phone that like more accurately represents, you know, the full 3D nature of your body. And then anything that they are like, maybe they're partnering with retailers, say in Essence, who has a huge stock of all these clothing, they're partnering with them, and like, they're also doing like full scans of all those clothing to get the actual dimensions. Cause only then does it really become useful for the try on thing in terms of like, oh, should I buy this thing because I know what it will look like on me? Like, you have to have that like continuous update of actual dimensions.
And Francis and Daisy, Francis, you mentioned you like to try on clothes. In general, do you like the experience of shopping in physical retail locations?
I do now, but only more and more, and only once I started making enough money that I could actually afford to buy a place in an in-person shopping, right? Like when I was in college, I mentioned this a couple months ago in an episode, like in Portland, Oregon, this shop Francis May, I went in a couple times to try something on specifically because I saw it on Grailed for quite cheap. And then I wanted to just go try it on and buy it, which is so shameless. And now I'm like, I do feel more ashamed of that sort of behavior, but I do like spending a Saturday and going around New York and like going into a couple of my favorite shops and trying things on now, even if I'm not going to buy the thing, because like I feel more comfortable in a shop where I can afford to buy it. Whereas before, I would only be able to buy a thing for a third of the price online, right?
I love how you say you feel shame about doing that. I feel no shame. It's like I was in Gentle Monster the other day trying on sunglasses, being like, oh, I'm going to bid on this in some type of e-com site. Like, ha, 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 ha. Daisy, I'm about to ask you the same question, but I think the thing that I would love someone to invent, or like, if I was a coder, which I'm so not, I would invent this. Mm-hmm. And actually Bill Gates' daughter is trying with this thing called Fear.
Yeah.
But
I've been following.
I would like something, and I would also like it to work in stores, where I can scan something with my phone and I can see every single place that exists on the internet, mm-hmm. Facebook Marketplace, eBay, Real Vestia, everywhere, and the varying price points.
Well, Google Shopping is kind of like a poor version, the poor man's version of this.
It's not doing it. Just it doesn't do it well enough. Like, as somebody who spends all my time, my spare, my hobby is this. And like, the thing that kind of pisses me off is I know there is definitely a world where some of these products are excluded because they have different keywords. But a lot of the time, that's not even happening. There are just these like data scraping silos, because I can search the same thing in multiple platforms and get different results than I get when I'm just shopping on Google.
Yeah, it's interesting, like watching the shift. So when I worked at Hodinkee, they were like custodying, I think it was like Hodinkee, and then they acquired this company Crown & Caliber because they wanted access to Crown & Caliber's inventory. Like, there was this idea that like, you know, it's better to like have the watches in hand and sell them. But then once I left Hodinkee, I started working for this company, or consulting with this company called Bezel. And instead they were creating like the Grail. So they were the listing agent for all of these watch dealers, who the watch dealers had the watches. People bought it on Bezel, and then, you know, the dealers sent it to that person directly. So they never had to deal with the supply chain of keeping the watches, beyond like being an additional authentication layer. Like, they really weren't responsible for the shipping or the like the quality of the watch or repairs or stuff like that. And so I think it's like going back to the Real, and then also Essence, a lot of the things that contributed to the bankruptcy were around their warehousing and inventory and the challenges to that. And so if Doji decided to pivot, I promise this relates to what we've been talking about. If Doji was like, we're going to be Essence, but like, we're going to let you try stuff on and tell you everything it is on the web, but we at no point will be responsible for the warehousing logistics of those things. Oh, like all of a sudden that's like really interesting, right? I also talked to a company called Lacondo yesterday that is sort of pitched as like the Spotify of fashion. They're backed by A16Z right now, the pre-seed level. You've heard of this. Danny's nodding.
I'm speaking to them next week.
Okay, yeah. So tell them I said hi. Yeah, as soon as we started talking, we're like, we know these people in common. But basically, like, you take a picture of your outfit, it anonymizes you, and your fit pics basically get fed into the algorithm of everyone using this platform. So people can search for things by vibes. They could search for specific pieces and brands, and then they're sort of drawing on the compendium of everyone's anonymized fit pics to get more data on, like, you can know, you can track over time, what do you actually wear of what you own? But you can also start to see data portraits of like what other people are wearing and discover things. And I was telling my friend Allison about this, and she was like, oh, I've kind of just been doing that, like, lo-fi. Like, when she started dating her boyfriend, like, he encouraged her to like take pictures of her outfits so she would know what she was wearing the most of, how she was putting it together. And I think a lot of people do that, and a lot of them don't even like post the outfits online. So yeah, I think we're like, I don't know that AI will kill the fit pic. I think like AI might usher in like the golden era of the fit pic.
But what do you think that means for the clout around taste? So like something.
Oh, that's what I was gonna ask you. So you have to tell us what you think, because you're the guest.
I mean, I wrote my Doji follow-up, my follow-up piece of the piece that was posted in Dirt, basically around this idea of the like the commodification or automation of taste when it comes to fashion. And like the argument I made was that, kind of circling back to the very beginning of the conversation, yes, obviously there's been this, like, let's call it the nouveau riche taste layer, which is like, oh my God, look at my outfit. It's Louis Vuitton monogrammed everywhere. It costs so much money. It means I have great fashion. Like, obviously it doesn't mean you have good fashion. It's terrible. Unless it's ironic, then it's very funny. But, you know, the real clout is celebrities wearing, for example, Archive. Like, it's the same as with anything. It's like, yes, your money could buy this, but actually you need access to do this. You need access to buy a Rothko, arguably. Like, even if you're a billionaire, if you're not cool, you can't, it's tacky, you're tacky. And I think the thing that Doji makes very interesting is Doji can make it seem like you are wearing any Archive piece. So if that then translates into fit pics, how is that going to change the way that people convey clout from what they're wearing? On the kind of other side is, you know,
there's no Getty watermark on it. It's not fucking real. That's how it's going to translate. Well, you can easily
put one on.
Well, yeah, there's the market for that. There's my next fundraise.
Oh, Daisy, I love this for you.
Danny, let's just spin up a Getty watermark product.
Well, you could buy
me and tribute. And you can add it to anyone's photo.
Finish this episode.
Let's do it.
All right, we're going to pivot this to a business session.
No. Okay, Danny, what are you going to say?
I was going to say that then there's kind of like another thing, which obviously is happening across all industries, but specifically across the creative industry, which is like, what does it mean when computer says yes and it can tell you what to do? So having good taste is obviously the fact that like you pulled the reference images, you put the clothes together, you did all this stuff. And if Ulta or Doji is telling me what a cool outfit is, and then I'm just putting it on, that's not like
you
that's
don't know
not
what
me
a cool
anymore.
Outfit is
that's
anymore either. Yeah.
That's not cool. In the same way that if ChatGPT writes an exquisite essay,
mm-hmm. I want to quote something from your most recent newsletter. Give me a second. It's kind of an
which was not
quote.
Written by ChatGPT.
Not written by ChatGPT. Well, that's kind
I
of
mean,
the point. So okay,
I will never
extended quote here. Capitalism's cardinal value is monetizing each drop of sweat that leaks from a worker's brow. Technologies is optimizing the minutiae of existence. When the two intersect, they birth a specter of disruption that slips through previously impervious walls to terrorize the labor force. Over the past three centuries, this ghost has been summoned with increasing frequency, emerging from machine after machine to reinvent the body. The first set of industrial revolutions mechanized our fingers with the electric loom, our arms with the production line, and our legs with the steam engine. The mind. The digital revolution enhanced our processing power, automating rudimentary mental tasks and expanding our capacity to access and analyze information. And finally, this is the last part, most recently, the soul. In the last 3 years, AI has come for passion, automating products that hinge on the imagination and dedication that blooms into skill. So that's kind of what you'd been just saying here. So I wanted to crystallize it in your words for the listener.
Francis, please, can you read out everything I've ever written? That was like the most validating experience of my whole life.
Happily. It was really good. It was really good.
So yeah, I think it's a, I think when I was thinking about the soul thing, I was really like, I think this idea of like, it's not only this idea that imagination can be, and I very much mean quote unquote synthesized, but it's also the fact that in order to master your art form, you needed to dedicate yourself to it. And then, you know, the way that I close it out is with that insane quote from, and I'm going to mispronounce this person's name, Adam Mastrolini, from his 28 incredibly rude notes on writing. And essentially, to paraphrase his argument, it was the fact that beautiful prose in and of themselves do not hold value.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or like they do in the way that like looking at a beautiful AI generated image does because of, let's say, the golden ratio or something like that. What is baked into cultural creation done by humans is the sacrifice or the opportunity cost implicit. Like the fact that I dedicated my time, my energy, my blood, my sweat, my tears, my mortality, mm-hmm. all in all, to this practice is part of what charges it with meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a hard thing because you can't watermark that. The only thing you can do is, which I now think is going to be important for every single creative, every single startup, every single employee, is reiterate the narrative that I created this, mm-hmm. this is why, this is how, and tell your story like artists have been doing for centuries. But I wish there was some type of way to watermark humanity.
Yeah, well, that's in person. That's in person shopping. That's talking in person, right? The only way to watermark humanity is to do it is to not mediate through a computer.
Yeah, I also think like venture capital has swung so far in the direction of saying basically like grit, passion, hard-won knowledge about your subject matter as a founder is worth less than the illusion of value, which is how you end up with stuff like Story Protocol, which is like a protocol that basically nobody uses that raised an ungodly amount of money to put, quote, IP on chain. It was not founded by people who are passionate about storytelling. It was founded by people who could effectively reward their early investors by raising more money on the previous round. And that train obviously stops at some point. Mm-hmm. But you can see the lack of passion because like, as soon as you know, some of the leadership had vested their like token allocation, they were like, I'm out. And so it will be interesting to see what AI does to the division in the startup world between mission-driven people and mercenaries. Mm-hmm. Because I would say like, if you're a mercenary, you are determined to make it into that like top 10%, 50% consumer spending class as soon as possible at all costs. And it's working. And I think, you know, there's this meme format of the permanent underclass. I actually don't think it's funny. I actually think it's quite dark. Because what people are basically saying is like, we are building in our economy towards a system where there's no upward mobility whatsoever. Which, I mean, Danny, you can speak to the way that this works in the UK. Like, UK has more of a permanent class system than the United States, or at least in the mythology of what it is. But there's still, you know, people talking to each other and collaborating, and there's a culture of patronage, and there's also like good benefits. So like you have a public health system. You know, what would it mean in the United States to have permanent classes, no upward mobility, and also no UBI or benefits or public health system? I mean, it would be a disaster. It's a disaster any place it's ever happened, and usually leads to like violent revolution. And so when people talk about the permanent underclass thing, it's like, you're mimetically prepping people to accept a system that would be the beginning of the downfall of our social fabric and political fabric. And I just think it's so bizarre, because if AI is going to work and be widely adopted, I personally, if I was an advocate of AI, and I wouldn't consider myself an advocate, I would consider myself somebody who wants to work with the available technologies. Like, the narrative that I would be pushing mimetically, you know, and whatever, would be like closer to like the abundance thing that's happening right now, the abundance conversation. Oh, AI will usher in permanent and infinite class mobility. So those, like, it's interesting to see those two thought systems like mingling on X, especially like right now. And it feels weird because it feels like not the real world, but also very much the real world.
I think it's really interesting. I think, you know, for me, from like a purely ideological standpoint, it all dates back to like John Rawls's Veil of Ignorance, like design a society as if you're the lowest person in it. Mm-hmm. And I think what we have in the UK that's great is we have benefits for people that allow them to live, like healthcare. The fact you guys don't have this in America is absolutely nuts. And obviously there is, I would say, partially because of the inbaked class system, going back to the thing we said before, coming from privilege is seen as pretty embarrassing in England. Like, it's something you are ashamed of because you are,
you can't wash yourself from it fully. You can never wash yourself from it.
No.
Like, if you're a lord, you're a lord.
Yeah, but it's not even if you're a lord, you're a lord. Like, I remember when I was 90, like, it's something that I've always been conscious of, like, in terms of the education I got, or like, my mum comes from Manchester, which is a much less well-off part of the UK, and her parents taught her to speak nicely. That was like the most important thing. Mm. So it's like all of these small social codes implicit in your behaviors. And like, I remember being 19 and no, it was like exact. It was like when I was 22 and I just graduated college and I was about to get my first job. And it was like all about all of the implicit things that give you privilege. And I was like, shit, even if I don't ask anyone for an introduction, I'm still so privileged. Like, what do I do? Like that, like, That is literally called being English is being embarrassed about like everything you as an American, and I don't mean you guys, but I mean like it would like show off about. I think, you know, the flip side of that is in England, it's a bit cringe to have ambition. And I think there is a lot more anger at wealth and privilege because it's this idea that like, how did you get that? I could never get that. Whereas somebody on the street in America, especially in New York, there's still this kind of, if I hustle enough, I could get to where you are. So I don't think there's as much animosity as there is in the UK, which is something that I find very interesting.
Did you watch Industry?
Dizzy, why? You are literally, I started watching Industry, I'm not joking, 10 days ago.
Oh my God.
Okay.
I started watching it on a plane. I started with season 3. All I've done for the past like 10 days is being like, hey, everyone, I'm watching Industry. Are you watching Industry? I'm watching Industry. Are you watching Industry? And then also being like, am I becoming a trader by osmosis? Like, there are some very complex things going on just in terms of like financial lingo in this show. Like, there'll be quite a lot of situations where I'm like, something bad is happening, but I have no idea what. Like, I just got to the, you know, when Harper is doing... is doing this trade with Rishi with like, she like puts her finger down and she's selling, like it's a whole thing. And I actually would like to spend some time researching. They're doing some arbitrage, but like it's pretty complex. But please carry on with what you're saying. Cause yes, I am currently obsessed with Industry.
We had the creators on this podcast and they were talking about a lot of the entrenched class stuff. Cause we were talking about Harper as like, she's the character that drives the plot forward. She's the chaos agent because she represents that sort of American striving. And to a certain extent, like her boss does as well, Eric. And that's why they have that relationship. But it's like Industry would not have the tension to be prestige television if they weren't mixing Americans and Brits in the show, because so much of what drives the tension forward is that the different, like the willingness to strive or different ways of being Machiavellian, even Rishi and his desire to prove himself and, you know, be accepted in that cricket club community. Oh, like, God. I feel like we already know some of the next season's going to be filmed in New York. And I wonder if it will take away some of that tension, because like we said on the episode, there's thousands of Harpers in New York. I mean, New York is just made up of
Pipers. The thing I find so weird, by the way, about the way that there's this framing, is there's this framing that she is a terrible person. And like, I don't get that at all. Like, for me, she's one of the most likable characters. Yasmin, zero, like, no.
It's because you went to all-girls school with hundreds of Yasmins.
Yeah, but like, Yasmin is dumb.
Yeah.
And she's a bitch. And like, Harper is a hustler and like
well adapted.
I think she's a badass as well. And she's out for herself, but quite frankly, in that environment, so should everybody else be. And I think in general, the way she does it is like pretty elegant. Whereas like Yasmin, I really dislike, but that's why I find it so weird. All of these things, like people being like, you're so selfish or a sociopath. I'm like, she isn't really. She's just like good at her job and actually smart and like hustling. Don't know what type of person that makes me, but
I think that that's like definitely interested in talking after you've seen like all three seasons. But I do think this idea of Harper as like a narcissist is a little bit overblown, because what the show really does is like sort of like what the Sopranos did, where it's like you can have this logic of the like, you know, if you're in the mafia, what is a virtuous move within that system is different from what is like broadly virtuous. Like if you're in a bank, what is a virtuous move within that system is different from what's broadly virtuous. But every character, at some point in the show will have their narcissism revealed. No character is all good or all bad. I think we root for Harper more as the underdog because she's
you know, she's coming from nothing and we're all primed to like root for her, like the Tony Soprano or the Don Draper.
And speaking of the Sopranos, we're going to end this episode right here quite suddenly. This has been Tasteland. Thank you for listening.
We all died.
We're all dead.